We have four matters this morning, and the first one is number 19-3241, Yale versus Warden, Monmouth County Correctional Institution et al., Messrs. Lustberg and Sampat. Mr. Lustberg.
Thank you, Judge Ambrose. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Lawrence S. Lustberg from the law firm of Gibbons PC. On behalf of the appellants, I would respectfully request 2 minutes for rebuttal.
No problem at all.
Thank you, Your Honor. This case, Your Honors, asks the question whether it is appropriate to detain an individual pending removal, potentially for months or even years, without giving him the opportunity to show that he will never, in fact, be ordered removed. In so doing, the case goes really to the very heart of the liberty that due process protects.
So the question is, to what extent does this person fit within 1226C? What standard do you want us to adopt in order to assess that question?
Your Honor, there's actually two questions, and the one you asked is only part of it. So
correct.
The first question is whether a person fits within 1226C. And the second question is whether, even if they do, they should have the right to raise the question about whether they will ultimately be deported, because they will have the opportunity and will potentially likely obtain either cancellation of removal or adjustment under the relevant statutory provisions. That means that they will never actually be removed or deported. That really, fundamentally, Your Honor, is the question. With regard to both, our argument is that the standard, we suggest a standard that is that if a detainee under those circumstances has a substantial argument that they will not be removed, that they then are entitled to a bond hearing. Not that they would be released, but at that point, they would be entitled to a bond hearing at which their risk of flight and or danger to the community can be considered. That is the standard that we propose. And it's a standard, Judge Ambrose, that we don't make up out of whole cloth. It's a standard that we derive from the Bail Reform Act. I can't believe I call it the Bail Reform Act after all these years. It was 1984. But anyway, under our bail statutes, that makes clear that for bail pending appeal, that what a court assesses, in addition to risk of flight and danger to the community, is whether a defendant under those circumstances has a substantial argument.
It was also a position that I believe was espoused by Justice Breyer and Judge Tashima on the Ninth Circuit. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct. So that's another way in which we're not making it up out of whole cloth.
But wasn't that rejected by the majority? I mean, to the extent the DeMoor majority was unwilling to take that on, we're looking at for in terms of analogies, things like, you know, pretrial detention or even parole revocation hearings seem closer. Why wouldn't we be looking at a probable cause standard with the burden, as it typically is where there's a deprivation of liberty, on the government?
So, Your Honor, let me first address your point about DeMoor. You're right, of course, that the majority in DeMoor did not adopt that position. Nor, however, did the majority in DeMoor even opine on the question that's before this court today.
Did anyone other than Justice Breyer espouse that position?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. But
I think that's correct.
Yeah,
you're the only one.
But the issue really was not presented by DeMoor, and DeMoor says that one of the things that DeMoor clearly says is that the appropriate standard for these so-called Joseph hearings is one that it was not going to confront in that context. It simply wasn't going to deal with it. And this court in Diop has likewise said that DeMoor did not resolve that question. So that's the answer to your first part of your question, Judge Krause. With regard to the second part of your question, which has to do with burdens, obviously the burden, we quarrel with the burden that's set forth in Joseph, which is one that's imposed upon the detainee. But our bigger quarrel, and I just want to focus because there's a lot of issues in this case, but our bigger quarrel is with the idea that one has no opportunity to even advance the argument that at the end of the day, he or she will not be deported. That undermines the whole purposes of detention. And we know from that the Constitution requires that in cases of detention, the most fundamental of all liberty interests are at stake, and the procedural protections to which one is entitled should be very great.
But what do we do with the language in Damore and Jennings and Priop that anticipates that the ultimate decision about removal is yet to be made, and anticipates the possibility that a petitioner will not be removed?
Yes. So let me be clear about that. There's two arguments that we advance, one of which is that language is ambiguous, and I'll come back to that in a second. But Your Honor, our more fundamental point is that as a matter of procedural due process, it is simply unconstitutional to not allow a person who's going to be detained for potentially months or years to not even advance an argument that he or she will ultimately never be deported. The government makes the argument that that would require, you know, mini hearings or whatever to peek into the merits. Courts are, in my experience, really good at that. They do it in the bail context initially when they look at the merits of the case to decide whether someone's going to be released. They are required to look at the strength of the evidence, I think is the phrase. They do it for bail pending appeal when they decide whether there's a substantial issue. They do it in the preliminary injunction context when they decide whether there's a likelihood of success in the merits. That is, they peek at the merits as a preliminary matter. And I have no question but that immigration judges can do this. Indeed, they do it already in the context of determinations as to whether detention is too prolonged. One of the things they look at is the ultimate merits. But to your point, you know, your point goes to the question of what is in the statute. We, as I said, say that the statute is ambiguous. But even if it isn't, even if the statute stands clearly for the idea that those types of arguments cannot be made, then it violates due process. Then it is a fundamental constitutional question. And you know, the government in their brief skillfully tries to make this into a question of strictly of statutory interpretation. It isn't. It's a matter of respectfully of constitutionality.
With your suggested test, substantial question, what do you mean by substantial?
Your Honor, we don't define that. And of course, this court doesn't actually have to either, because what it could do if it were to strike down the statute, then it would be up to the other branches of government to set forth what the appropriate standard is. But what I mean by it is, and again, here, we don't write on a blank slate. This court has said in its jurisprudence regarding a bail pending appeal that a substantial question is one that's fairly debatable. My concept here is that a detainee would have the obligation to come forward with proof that he or she is has a substantial basis to believe that he or she will never be deported. By the way, statistically, that's not a crazy claim. As we set forth in our papers and as the record here makes clear, 41% of the people in the class at issue here actually made those applications, and 50% of them had them granted. So something like 20% of the people, if my math is right, actually ultimately never get deported, notwithstanding that they're held for years. But what this court and others do on bail pending appeal applications is take a look and see whether they have a colorable basis, a substantial basis, a fairly debatable basis. A standard like that, Judge Ambrose, is the one that we have in mind.
But as the question is still is as to what, and as you recognized at the outset, there are a couple different issues here. Mm-hmm. One is simply whether an alien falls into a category
of
1226C. If that's what we're dealing with, then perhaps the focus of our inquiry should be what is the right burden there? Is it something greater than preponderance? Is it clear and convincing? Is it probable cause? You're asking us to sweep in other forms of relief that assume that there has already been a determination about removability or inadmissibility. But where we now have in the picture cases like Barton v. Barr, in our opinion in Kahn, don't we have instruction from the Supreme Court that things like inadmissible by reason of having committed an offense or deportable is simply a status? And so the focus really needs to be on fitting into that category and leaving aside what Congress and the Supreme Court in Damore arguably have already decided, which is if you fall into that category, there's an irrebuttable presumption that arises.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I'm not so sure that Congress decided that, but if they did impose that irrebuttable presumption, then that would be unconstitutional. But having said that, you're quite right that we don't really assist the court that much in terms of saying what the standard ought to be. We say two things in our papers here, and it's our position. First of all, that the burden should be on the government to prove that one belongs in the category of offenses that give rise in the category of people that belong in the mandatory
detention. But your proposed test all it does is talk about the detainee. What burden should be on the government, by the way?
The government should bear the burden of showing, and we think the standard of probable cause is too low. I would be respectfully think that a standard of at least a preponderance would be required, that a person belongs in the category of people who are subject to mandatory detention. This is important because in some of these areas, things like crimes involving moral turpitude or aggravated felony are often the subject of tremendous dispute between the parties. And there are real questions that arise as to whether someone belongs in that category or doesn't, and as to whether offenses belong in that category or didn't. In this case, in our cases, one of our named plaintiffs, it was a significant issue. And ultimately, this court concluded that Mr. Suku's offense was not a crime involving moral turpitude. The government should bear the burden if somebody's going to be deprived of their liberty of showing that in the very first instance. But even if they successfully do it, I really want to focus the court, if at all possible, on the question, which I respectfully think was not at all decided by Damore, as to whether once you're in that category, you necessarily have to be held without even a bond hearing at which you could show that you are not a risk of flight or a danger to the community, because you are likely never to be deported, as opposed to sitting in prison for months or even years without having that opportunity.
So that issue that you're focusing on, you don't take issue with the government's reading of the statute that says that's the outcome under the statute. You're just saying that statute is not constitutional in light of due process principles, right? That is the reading of the statute, right?
Well, Your Honor, we do take the position that the statute is ambiguous and that that principles of constitutional avoidance should counsel a reading that would be clearly constitutional. There's good arguments for the ambiguity of the statute. The government itself concedes that the word deportable is used in more than one way in the statute. We point the court to, for example, and I'll get the specific provision, but the provision of the statute that I think it's 1147A, 1101A47, which equates deportable with entering an order of deportation.
Doesn't deportable unambiguously mean that non-citizens are subject to removal?
I don't want to really press here today the ambiguity argument as much as we do in our brief. I do think that there's a good argument that there's some confusion as to that Congress knows how to say irrespective of any relief from removal. There's a common sense, Judge Ambrose, interpretation of the idea that one is not removable or deportable unless if they're not going to be deported. And by the way, even in Damore, the notion of deportability is defined in terms of the quote from Damore as successful removal from the country. So I think that there's an argument that it's ambiguous, but our main argument today is that even if it's to Judge Phipps' point, is that even if we were to concede that the statute is clear in that point, that renders the statute constitutionally vulnerable. Indeed, I think it's really, you know, it outrageous that somebody could be held for such a long time, even though it's could be ascertained from the outset that they will never have to leave the country.
Although on that point, in terms of time, unreasonably long time, doesn't German Santos deal with that?
Well, what German Santos says, and what the cases regarding length of time say, is that there does come a time when a when detention is too long to be constitutionally appropriate. But that's a long time. So what we could be talking about is for months and months, even before you reach the point at which the detention is outrageously long, someone is sitting in prison, even though it could have been ascertained at the outset that that was not what was likely to happen. And the notion that somebody can't even make that showing and then can't proceed to a bond hearing where they can show that they are not a risk of flight or danger to the community, which is, by the way, what Congress was really worried about when it passed IRIRA at the time, is to me something that should be taken into account in determining whether the procedures are adequate.
One fact question before, and maybe you won't know this, before we move on to another issue that you brought up, which is the contemporaneous record, whether mm-hmm. it needs to be made of there in order to comply with due process. Of the 41% who challenge removal, do you know how many are in the first category, that is they are or are not subject to 1226C, and how many are in the discretionary category? In other words, they get discretionary relief.
No, those are the numbers for, as I understand it, and I will check this and be happy to provide something to the court to confirm, but I believe that the record is pretty clear that those are all people in category C. Those are all mandatory detention cases and not 1226A cases.
Okay. Do my colleagues have any further questions on this first issue before we switch gears?
Just to clarify, I put words in his mouth, but I understood Judge Ambrose's question not to go to 1226A versus C, but in the category of 1226C.
How many
of those were, whether they fit into the category at the first step versus whether they had an argument for relief from removal.
Thank you for translating Judge Ambrose for me. I apologize, Judge Ambrose, for not interpreting.
No problem.
The all 41%, well, every one of those people are people who applied for discretionary relief under one of three provisions, either for cancellation, for adjustment, or for asylum. All of them fall into that category. So all of them were people who fell within the category of people who may be mandatorily detained, but ultimately nonetheless were not deported. And okay. and I would refer the court to on summary judgment, there were pleadings, and I can give the court the appendix site to that. This was an undisputed set of facts.
So Mr. Lesberg, none of those were, for example, challenging whether it was a categorical match, whether it was an offense that that rendered them inadmissible or removable?
Well, they may have had those challenges as well, but those statistics control for that. That is, those statistics for the people who had already been held by the immigration court to fall within the category, they were already sat category C people who were being held under category C, that they had committed either a crime of moral turpitude or a aggravated felony. And so now they were applying for the discretionary relief, but all of them did fall within the category of people who were quote unquote deportable, as Judge Phipps was using the phrase earlier.
Before we move on to records, could I just step back to an answer you gave previously about that you think if we were looking even at the first step, that is category, that the standard should be at least preponderance. Mm-hmm. Should we understand from that you're not advocating a clear and convincing standard?
I will tell you, we have not done that. We have not advocated a clear and convincing standard. Of course, I would be thrilled with a clear and convincing standard. I think it's justifiable. Look, we all know that both burdens and standards of proof depend upon the interests involved. And when you're talking about something as serious as detention, I think a clear and convincing standard is would be appropriate. And by the way, I should note that in most of these cases, and maybe this is the segue to records anyway, I mean, in the vast majority of these cases, there's no real dispute as to that. It's really simply a matter of looking at what the conviction was and applying the law the law to that fact. So I'm not sure that the standard actually applies, but you know, but there are at times disputed facts. There are times when both a detainee testifies and government officials testify. Obviously, we think a record should be made of that, so courts can exercise meaningful appellate review. But in any event, yes, I mean, I think a clear and convincing standard would absolutely be appropriate given the interests involved. But I have to, you know, obviously in candor to the court, we didn't brief that issue.
Well, why don't you turn to the contemporaneous record? What is your understanding of the record that's currently kept at Joseph hearings?
There, notwithstanding that there's recording equipment in the courtrooms, that recording equipment is turned off. We had a pretty extraordinary deposition in this case where we actually deposed the head of the chief immigration judge for the district, who testified that that's what they do. Instead, there was no contemporaneous record made. Instead, there's simply a sheet with boxes that are checked. And that's the full record that makes its way up to the Board of Immigration Appeals.
So if the question is whether an alien has committed an aggravated felony, I mean, isn't the sheet pretty good? I mean, you check a box and say, I mean, that's not too many facts, not too many issues that are ever going to be recorded.
Yeah.
Do you need anything more than that box being checked? That box being checked probably gives you just about anything you ever, or not checked, gives you just about anything you need for later. Now, there might be other instances where you could say, gee, it's fact dependent or something else like that's in play. But it strikes me that there's at least some instances where the box is sufficient on its own for the record.
There are some instances, Your Honor, but two quick observations on that. First of all, the fact that there are some instances where the facts are not really disputed doesn't mean that there shouldn't be an opportunity to dispute them when there are disputes. And let me just give you an example of a case that I'm involved in now, and this is not part of the record. I apologize for that. But I mean, it does happen that there's a dispute in the aggravated felony context about whether there was $10,000 involved, because that's the threshold for aggravated felony. And so there will be testimony as to whether the offense did or did not involve $10,000, for example. The concern here, and this is the second point I wanted to make, and we make this point in our briefs, is that there are times when immigration judges do not give the parties an adequate opportunity to argue those facts or to present them. This court has reversed a number of BIA decisions based upon pretty significant misconduct on the part of immigration judges. Misconduct that would not come to light were it not for the fact that in those cases, because they were in a different setting, there was a full record made. This issue really has to do with the ability of this court and the BIA, which reviews the determinations in the first instance, to do their job. I can't imagine.
But isn't the relief that you seek over inclusive? I mean, there's some instances where a recording, where a paper record is sufficient. And so then the relief that you seek is to kind of mandatorily compel recording in all instances, including those in which a paper record is sufficient. I mean, it strikes me that there would be kind of smaller steps along the way where you could say a person in a Joseph hearing, an alien in a Joseph hearing, has the option to request recording and they must be given that option, as opposed to saying every single one of these must be as a matter of constitutionalism. I mean, that strikes me as a very over-inclusive rule of con law. Why aren't there smaller, kind of more bite-sized approaches to con law that you could present instead of kind of asking for the whole con law mouthful?
Yeah, I think you're right that there are smaller steps that could be taken in some cases, but think about this in this way. What we know is that if you had a transcript in every case, then you know that could easily take care of what's otherwise on a piece of paper. The judge could say, it would be a two-page transcript where the judge would say, I find this, 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 and this, and there's no dispute, and you would have a record of it. The flip side, that is to say, what's on the sheet of paper could easily be converted to the transcript, but the converse is not true. That is, if all you allow is a piece of paper, then you're never going to have what would otherwise be in the record.
I understand that, but as a point of con law, why is the rule that the transcript is mandatory? Why not just give the alien in the Joseph hearing the option of recording it? Why not just say, hey, we can record this if you want? I mean that's what happens in a lot of district court proceedings. I know that's oceans away by analogy, but court said, you want this on the record or not? Mm-hmm. Why isn't that enough under this very flexible due process standard to say, look, we gave you the option, you elected for it, or you chose against it. If you chose against it, due process, at least in this context, strikes me as subject to an alien's election. There are certain con law rights that you can elect out of. Why isn't this one of those, as opposed to being mandatory for all times, all places, in an over-inclusive way?
I understand your point, Your Honor, and I certainly think giving detainees under those circumstances the option is far better than the regime we have today, where they do not have that option, where it simply is never done. So it may in some subset of cases be constitutionally adequate. I would respectfully suggest that it's probably a better course to not leave that up to an uncounseled detainee and a judge, but rather just have a blanket rule, particularly where it's so easy. And by the way, it's become easier today where these proceedings are being done typically remotely anyway. So the equipment is there. There's really no excuse to not, in some ways the most administrable, simplest way is just to record the proceedings the way proceedings are recorded in courtrooms all around the country every day.
You may be right from a practical perspective, but I think Judge Phipps' question is, how can it be unconstitutional to give the option of recording to the detainee?
Yeah, so it may be that this is the sort of thing that is best decided as applied to a particular case. I think that the better course is for this court to provide some guidance as to what's required. If the answer is that there can be a knowing and voluntary waiver, Judge Phipps, you correctly suggest that those constitutional rights are knowingly and voluntarily waived every time. But respectfully, I think that, you know, if you talk about opening a Pandora's box, the Pandora's box that's going to be opened is, you know, did a detainee knowingly and voluntarily waive the right to have a transcript made? It's simply a matter of pushing a button, and it seems to me the easier and better way to do it. But I would agree with you that would be a step in the right direction.
Ms. Wellsberg, it seems that in making that sort of choice for it to be knowing and voluntary, it would be necessary to know how the decision was going to be rendered and what the decision was going to be, what the basis was going to be. Is there any sort of preview of that or announcement of that before an actual hearing and decision is rendered so that in deciding whether to record it or not, the non-citizen would be able to knowingly waive the right to record it?
Candidly, Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that question. I don't practice regularly in immigration courts. I would suspect, based upon the little I do know, that the answer to that question is yes sometimes and no other times, that sometimes somebody really does have a pretty good idea of what's going to happen, and sometimes it's hotly disputed. But honestly, I don't know the answer. Maybe that Mr. Sampat knows that answer to that question better than I do.
And do you know the percentage of those that are pro se cases versus counsel?
I don't know. I do know that the vast majority are pro se, but I don't know the exact percentages. And that was not part of the record here, unfortunately.
Could I step back to a couple questions?
Go ahead on the
standard. You've asked us to espouse the dissent in Damore. What about the dissent in Joseph?
So I've thought hard about that dissent in Joseph, which espouses a likelihood of success on the merits standard. And I have no real quarrel with a likelihood of success on the merits standard. It's a somewhat higher standard, I think, than a substantial argument standard. And I have espoused the substantial argument standard because that standard was approved by the Supreme Court as part of its ruling in Salerno that detention could be constitutional. So that's why we chose that standard to be clear. But my main argument is that there has to be some opportunity as a matter of procedural due process for a detainee to show that he's unlikely to be deported. I think the substantial argument standard is one that finds justification in more directly analogous statutory framework, and one that has been the subject of constitutional adjudication. But to be honest, I would not quarrel very much with a likelihood of success on the merit standard, which is what's proposed in the Joseph dissent.
Do you understand that likelihood of success on the merits to be going to both discretionary relief and the applicability of the particular categories, or just the former? I'm sorry, just the categories.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, so in Joseph, they were not dealing with the issue of whether one could raise questions of the likelihood of obtaining discretionary relief. So you're correct. That was really just going to the question about whether someone belonged in the 236C category. So you're right that they weren't really addressing that. Since then, decisions of the BIA have made clear that the question of discretionary relief plays no role whatsoever in these in Joseph hearings.
Any further questions?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and thank you for hearing us remotely. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Mr. Sampat.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court, Truman Sampat from the United States Department of Justice for the government. Neither the statutory language, the statutory construction, nor the Constitution creates the exception that class counsel provides to be for individuals that are going to be included in 1226C. As Judge Krause pointed out, the Supreme Court has addressed this three times already, and twice just in the last 3 years with its decisions, in DeMoore, Jennings, and Preop. So, you know, the government respectfully requests that this court affirm the district court's decision regarding the interpretation and constitutionality.
On burden allocation, you rely heavily on DeMoore, but back then it was the understanding that the delays were in the neighborhood of 5 months. And then, as you know, in 2016, the Solicitor General's letter sent to the court showed that average detentions are 382 days, a little more than a year. So we're seeing appeals where people were mandatorily detained for over a year or more. I mean, German Santos was more than that. So doesn't that mean here that a liberty interest is now staring us in the face as being particularly compelling?
So there is a liberty interest, but as this court's recognized, that liberty interest can be addressed on the back end by having this right of habeas where individuals can challenge prolonged detention, right? So there, this court,
go ahead, keep going. I'm just going
to. This court said in Diop and Chavez and Chavez Alvarez, in both cases where individuals were challenging their removability, that the constitutionality of 1226C wasn't the issue. It was a matter of whether or not, as a matter of constitutionality, their detention had become so prolonged such that a bond hearing was required. So that is a protection towards an alien's liberty interest while they're in detention, subject to mandatory detention.
But even as it has seemingly approved some sort of categorical detention, the court has also recognized that there is a showing to be made at the outset and has declined to opine to date on what that burden is to decide whether someone is subject to 1226C. That's really the issue for us today, and that, you agree, has not been addressed by the Supreme Court or our court.
Yes, we do concede that that has not been addressed by the Third Circuit nor by the Supreme Court. But to address the burden allocation argument, probable cause is used across other areas of the law numerous times, and the constitutionality of that has been upheld.
So I'm sorry for interrupting, but has probable cause ever been used in an area where a person subject to probable cause is looking at a detention of 382 days?
Not that we're aware, Your Honor, and happy to do further research to see, but
because probable cause may work for many, many, many things, mm-hmm. but does it work for mandatory detention under 1226C is the question here, and I guess whatever the standard is, you know, one of the thoughts is one of the ways to challenge whether you're in 1226C or whether you're in 1226A is identity. You could just say you've just got the wrong person. And so whatever the minimal standard is, shouldn't we be just confident that that standard makes sure that we aren't detaining the wrong person for 382 days? And is probable cause, maybe it is it a good enough standard to assure us that at the bare minimum, we've got the right person?
Yes, Your Honor. I think probable cause is the right standard because, again, the probable cause standard is for the government to show that this individual is subject to 1226C. It allows an alien to make the eventual, to respond accordingly and say, I am either not an alien, right? I'm not the person as you noted, Judge Phipps, or I am likely to prevail or that ICE is substantially unlikely to prevail on the count of I am subject to mandatory detention. So the burden then goes back to the alien to show that I or this individual may not be subject to 1226C. Again, the Joseph hearings are meant to be these preliminary custody determinations to simply determine whether or not somebody is subject to 1226C and mandatory.
I'm sorry for interrupting. You know, that's great. That makes a lot of sense if the real hearing were the next day or the next week. But I think the reality is maybe the real hearing isn't quite the next day or the next week. And so that time period that's in play, yes, there's back-end remedies for that, but those are back-end after detention's already happened. And so, you know, I mean, probable cause, if you had to handicap probable cause on a percentage scale, where do you put it? Is it somewhere between 33 and 40%, 25 and 33? Like roughly what is it? It's probably under 50, right?
Under 50, I think it would be a little difficult because, again, probable cause would depend on different circumstances of different individuals.
But I guess let's just say it's 40%. So we could have an identity issue and we could say, you know, we're going to detain this person for maybe 382 days because we have evidence at about 40% confidence rate that this is the right person. And you're saying that due process requires nothing more than that.
Yes, Your Honor, because it's that we have the right person, but again, we're what
the 40% confidence that it's the right person. 60%, right. 60% it's you've got the wrong person.
Right.
60% you've got the wrong person, but 40% you've got the right person. And so if it gets too long, there'll be back-end remedies. But those don't give you time back. Those are just kind of ways out, right?
Right. But again, for the alien, it almost seems like the most prudent course at that point is to move to terminate proceedings, not so much to argue about whether or not they're subject to 1226C, right? And that's a burden on the alien themselves, because again, I think it would be a little weird for somebody to file and argue about detention and whether or not they're subject to mandatory detention when their argument is we're not this individual. At that point, why not file a motion to terminate proceedings and say, I'm not this person. Immigration judge, please just let me out of custody and have the immigration make that determination right there.
Right. Isn't so the point that even if they do that may be months, even more than a year away?
I'm sorry, Judge Kress, when you say a month or a few months or a year away, you mean the determination on the motion to terminate?
Yes.
It may be some time away again, but you know, courts, you know, immigration courts are have a little bit of a backlog as the court has noted and recognized. But this all goes to the fact of what 1226C was meant for when it was passed by Congress, which was to address the evidence it had before it of individuals that were absconding at high rates, that were being released and then going out and having high crime rates and failing to appear for their removals ultimately. So the point of 1226C would be undermined if the government was not able to make this threshold determination at the beginning that somebody is subject to 1226C and then move forward from that.
But doesn't that just that seems to prove too much, because if the concerns are the risk of flight and potential danger that follows from someone properly being categorized in 1226C, then if there is proof that they do not belong in that category, whether as a categorical matter or because of discretionary relief, then don't those those two drivers of risk of flight and danger, don't they decrease accordingly?
They may decrease, but again, as this court's recognized through Diop, Chavez Alvarez, and then now German Santos, which is that determination is made for the later end as to whether or not the purpose of 1226C is being met. So an alien can then file after 6 months a habeas petition in district court saying that I have been litigating my removal in good faith, and therefore now my detention, my prolonged detention as a matter of constitutionality is questionable, and therefore I request a bond hearing before an immigration judge. So this,
let's say that conclude that there needs to be more scrutiny at the front end as to whether 1226C is applicable. What is your position as to who bears the burden and what that standard of proof should be? We do use probable cause in many circumstances, but typically there is some kind of burden shifting with the recognition that ultimately it's the government that has the burden of persuasion, and it's by clear and convincing evidence. Here you're asking us to accept the statute as including an irrebuttable presumption, at least at the outset. To trigger that irrebuttable presumption, doesn't it need to be something more than probable cause?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the government doesn't think so. We think the probable cause standard is appropriate and meets constitutional muster. But should the court, addressing your point of, you know, assuming that the court says that a different standard is required, I think it would be an issue that would probably need to be further briefed, because both parties haven't necessarily addressed those points. You know, as Mr. Lussberg pointed out, is that there's no real alternative that was proposed in their briefing, and the government never had an opportunity to respond. Now, preponderance may make sense, but again, this would be something that would probably be better addressed with additional briefing on that.
So if the standard were preponderance, just more likely than not, you'd have a stronger case, right? You could say, look, this is much, much more defensible. We've convinced ourselves at the front end that it's more likely than not that this person falls into the mandatory detainable section. That's a better argument than we have probable cause. You might have probable cause to you know, start the process, but once you want to continue the process with a detention, it seems that your argument would be a lot stronger if you could say, this is more likely than not. That's more defensible than probable cause. Probable cause is asking for a lot, isn't it?
Well, Your Honor, I would just ask if you could clarify what you mean when you said probable cause on the front end would be okay, but then after that would not, because...
No, on the very, very kind of on the reason to believe on what it takes to even start a detention hearing, right? To even start this process down the road before a Joseph hearing even takes place, there has to be some showing. The question is what needs to take place at the Joseph hearing. And so I can see probable cause having a role before a Joseph hearing,
Well, Your Honor, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to.
No. If you now understand, go ahead and respond.
Yeah. So I think the response to that though is that the Joseph hearing is that threshold hearing, right? In that an individual is taken into custody, right? So the way the process.
No. And so my question is, what's the initial threshold for taking someone into custody? I understand that to be almost like reason to believe, or you can't just indiscriminately take someone into custody. There has to be some showing there. It's somewhere between reason to believe and probable cause. And then the question is, what's the standard at the Joseph hearing, which you would expect would be a slightly elevated standard from the initial standard? That's what I'm getting at.
Okay. Again, I think for a Joseph hearing, these are preliminary hearings where we don't want to get bogged down, or it doesn't make much sense. It wouldn't be prudent, frankly, to get bogged down in whether or not somebody has a substantial challenge or something to whether or not they're subject to 1226C, because it would turn into these mini hearings where an immigration judge would have to make a determination as to whether or not someone is likely or may not be likely to get some form of relief. So the probable cause standard addresses that by saying, is this individual subject to 1226C? Just to borrow the court's example, is the government 40% sure that the individual is subject to 1226C because it either is the individual that's subject to mandatory detention or is substantially unlikely to prove that they're not, allows the government to again make that determination and say, this is the individual that is going to be detained. And should that individual's detention become so prolonged, they can then file a habeas petition in district court to seek relief.
But do we even need a Joseph hearing? I mean, isn't that probable cause standard met simply when ICE decides to issue a notice of removal? Why don't we just take that? That's based on a probable cause to believe the notice of removal is warranted for whatever charges are put in it. Why do we need at that point there to be any further hearing before the actual removal hearing?
Well, at that point, Your Honor, I think due process would require that hearing to have some review of whether or not somebody's subject to mandatory detention.
But you're saying it's the same standard that was already applied and already deemed satisfied by the agency.
But there's now a neutral arbiter to determine whether or not the DHS or ICE was proper in applying that standard to this specific individual. Right. So an immigration judge then.
So more due process happens, not necessarily by ratcheting up the standard, but by having a neutral arbiter, an opportunity to be heard and make your case. And I guess that's meaningful to the extent that a person detained can say the probable cause is lacking, whereas they don't get to make those same arguments to ICE agents who are executing a detainer.
Yes, correct, Your Honor.
But once that showing is made, the government's position is that at that point, the government has no further burden. The government's burden in terms of what it must show is the same as what ICE needed to show to issue a notice of removal.
Yes, at that point, Your Honor, it is the probable cause standard for the government to show, and which is rebuttable, again, by the alien to show whether that they are not the alien or that the government is substantially unlikely to prevail on the fact that the individual is subject to mandatory detention.
What distinguishes this situation from, say, Addington civil commitment context, where we require a clear and convincing standard to be satisfied before someone can be detained for a prolonged period? The burden being on the government to make that showing, not on the proposed detainee.
Well, Your Honor, as the Supreme Court has held numerous times and as this court has recognized as well, removal proceedings in the immigration context are not subject to the same sort of due process protections that those other proceedings are. So there is less due process protections available to individuals in this arena. And that is the way that Congress had created the statute and has operated by passing different provisions of the INA.
That may be true when it comes to the removal hearing, but again, we're talking about what you agreed at the outset was an open question about what the threshold showing needs to be to trigger that mandatory detention? And why shouldn't that be a burden on the government rather than the detainee? And why, when we're dealing with a sort of mandatory detention scheme, why shouldn't we look to the other mandatory detention schemes in our code that use a clear and convincing standard?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think for that, again, immigration proceedings are fundamentally different. And when it comes to detaining aliens subject to mandatory detention, what Congress intended in passing 1226C was to protect against individuals being released and going out and absconding, failing to appear for removals. So the probable cause standard as it currently exists properly reflects what Congress's intent was when it passed 1226C in ensuring that these individuals would be detained because they are subject to mandatory detention for some enumerated offense that they have committed or been convicted of.
Can I pivot to the, I don't know if my colleagues are up for this, but can I pivot to the mandatory recording issue?
That's, you took the words out of my mouth.
Oh, all right, we'll go through that. All right, perfect segue. Okay, so I mean, I guess my thought is why isn't some at least option to record in maybe not in every case, but why not giving a person facing this type of detention when they want to have their meaningful opportunity to be heard? We've already given them extra process, as you've said. We've got a neutral arbiter, an opportunity to be heard. We have no contemporaneous record. So kind of as procedure is given out under the Constitution, why doesn't the Constitution also suggest that in this Matthews v. Eldridge balancing flexible test that we at least give a person the option to record this, especially if it's going to involve a dispute under your view of probable cause?
So and there's a few answers to that, but the first is that the recording is really much, really sort of inconsequential, Your Honor, because most of these Joseph hearings turn on legal questions as to whether or not the conviction makes.
So let's say most of them do. Let's say most of it's check the box, aggravated felony or not. Okay, let's say most of them do. But what about the ones where it's identity, or cancellation or adjustment or something else?
I mean, or you're U.S. or you claim you're a U.S. citizen, for example.
Yeah, I mean, in those, that's different than whether second degree robbery in New Jersey is an aggravated felony, right? And so that I don't know that. Yeah, I mean, that's just a question of law. But your brief says facial challenges, but there's also factual challenges, and sometimes they may bring a factual challenge and say, hey, the factual record actually matters to me here, because I want to tell you that it's my cousin that you're after, not me, and we have the same name.
So the two responses to that are, first, the alien's not deprived of their opportunity to present those facts, which they can do via affidavit and declarations and other written documents that can be presented at the Joseph hearing. And the second thing is that an alien can request that the hearing be recorded, but it is left to the immigration judge to decide whether or not it's warranted. There are times where an immigration judge may record it, it is possible. But the question here is whether or not, as a matter of constitutionality, a recording is required at all times. And Judge Phipps, as you acknowledged during Mr. Lustberg's time, it seems to be an overreach to say that's what the Constitution requires. So it's not that an individual is deprived of the opportunity to ask for a recording. They may request one if needed or if they would like, but it's left to the immigration judge in his or her discretion to determine whether one is warranted or not.
So can we get to the other question that I think Judge Krause and Mr. Lustberg were talking about? Well, this is kind of the how do you know question, Mm-hmm. Well, if we don't record it, how do we know if a question was ever made? I mean, this is kind of feels like philosophy to me a little bit, you know, but at one level, if we don't ever record it, how do we know? I mean, maybe we can just a form afterwards says no request was made to record, and maybe that's good. And then the question, you know, do we say no knowing voluntary intelligent request was made? Or, yeah, I mean, how much do you have to put on the box? And where do we go if it's a waiver? And if it's not a waiver, that means that there's no right. And so I guess if we find there's no right, then there's no need for a waiver. It was just an option that was made out of just, you know, the beneficence of the neutral at the Joseph hearing. It was more than the Constitution allowed. And so maybe there's not a need for a waiver, but how do we know if there's not some recording? We're just going to accept the paper record afterwards?
Well, yes, Your Honor, in the sense of, you know, it's an immigration judge who prepares a bond memo to talk about, that outlines what happened at the hearing, and then we'll write it into a decision if that decision is then appealed. But again, this is no different than any other civil appeal, right? In the sense that if parties submit a summary judgment motion in district court and there's a hearing, that decision is reviewed based on the decision in order that the district court reviewed the orders, not on what happened at the hearing, correct? So it would, it's similar in that vein where and almost really analogous to say those recordings are not required there shouldn't be one required here. But again, this, you know, this court has said on a couple of occasions that a verbatim transcript is not even required for in the criminal context. It said that in Saunders, it said that in Fahey, and it said that in Crutchley, that, you know, there is no verbatim transcript needed as a matter of due process when an individual has a criminal trial or a criminal hearing.
What's your justification for not keeping an audio recording of Joseph hearings? Wouldn't it be easier? Less burdensome as opposed to doing a post-hearing memo?
Well, Your Honor, it's the argument here is a matter of what the Constitution requires. And the government's position is that the Constitution does not require a recording of those hearings. Now, there is also the issue of there are two separate, I guess the way to analogize it are servers that hold removal proceedings and bond proceedings separately because the statute requires that. So, you know, it would be a matter of how those are stored and of that such. And again, this was not necessarily briefed by the parties but it's a matter, the government's argument here is that just a matter of constitutionality, a recording is not.
Is there witness testimony at Joseph hearings?
Or can there be? I'm sorry, Your Honor, you cut out.
Can there be witness testimony at Joseph hearings?
Potentially, but most of them really do turn on conviction documents as to whether or not somebody committed this convicted of this crime, what that crime was, and whether or not that makes them subject to mandatory detention. That's how that is my understanding of how most of these Joseph hearings move forward.
Mr. Sepat, didn't your own witness at Joint Appendix 417 to 18 and 425 say that detainees sometimes testify at Joseph hearings, and that testimony was relevant to establishing entitlement to relief, that there are at times credibility determinations to be made and testimony that is given at least by the detainee, if not other witnesses. Doesn't that counsel in favor of having some record of what was actually said?
It does, Your Honor, but it doesn't need to be a contemporaneous record. Again, the immigration judge is sitting there, you know, and preparing a bond memo, is listening to the testimony and prepares this memo that is then eventually turned into a written decision if appealed to the BIA. So,
what is the burden on the government in terms of turning on the recording equipment?
My understanding, Your Honor, is that there are two switches or buttons, for lack of a better word or phrase, that require immigration judges to turn on, to turn off the removal proceedings segment or server, and then to turn on the bond hearing proceedings and to record it there.
So the burden on the government here that we're considering on the other side of the Matthews test is to flip two switches?
That is my understanding, Your Honor. But again, it's a matter of the burden on the government, and the burden on the government is not dispositive of whether or not the Constitution requires the hearing at the outset.
Well, right? on the other side, I'm sure the government would not dispute that having a verbatim record facilitates appellate review.
Yes, Your Honor. I think we would concede that, but again, there's not much to be gained with the verbatim or contemporaneous record here, because most of these hearings do turn on.
So, a lot of this comes down to like law of averages. Like sometimes it may just turn on whether something's an aggravated felony. Sometimes it may involve a lot of witness testimony and a lot of facts and a lot of other things. And so it seems that there's problems on both sides, right? Because the problem that you face is not recording is a problem for the instances that aren't just is aggravated, you know, is this crime an aggravated felony? That's a problem on your side. The problem on the other side is that this is a class, it's a B2 class. And we have Jennings interpreting Walmart v. Dukes, which says you have to give meaningful relief to every person in connection with their grievance. And if this class is everyone, regardless of what sort of challenge they bring, then there's this other problem of, well, what about the people who don't really have a due process trigger, where the pure question of law may be addressed by a form afterwards, versus the other set of people who are in the same class who may be really big cancellation, adjustment, identity issues. And so it strikes me that both sides have a problem, since this is a class. If it was an individual, we might be able to look at one individual case and say, well, in this individual circumstance, more was required. But in other cases, I'm not sure more is required. So isn't your strongest argument not that there are gaps, but that Jennings says that there has to be class-wide relief that remedies an injury that every class member has sustained?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's part of the argument, is that, you know, the class-wide relief that's granted has to benefit the entire class, which is not necessarily the case here. But, you know, but on top of that, it's also a matter of immigration judges exercising certain discretionary authority to determine when those recordings are required and when not. So that would be, as you acknowledge, Your Honor, you know, certain cases may require it where there is some factual record that needs to be developed and needs to be properly recorded. And for those circumstances, an immigration judge can and sometimes do turn on the recording equipment to allow them to have a contemporaneous recording of the hearing itself.
Any further questions of my colleagues?
Thank you. Mr. Sampa, do you agree that the right to appellate review is required by due process in this context?
In the context of a Joseph having review to a Joseph hearing?
Yes.
There is a right to a review in that an individual subject to 1226, an immigration judge finding an individual subject to 1226C can then appeal it to the Board of Immigration Appeals, yes. And if I may, Your Honor, can I just touch on one final point just for a minute on the 1252F1 issue?
Go ahead.
The district court did exceed its jurisdictional authority by granting injunctive relief. As this court acknowledged, and it's the last time we were before the court, you know, there were serious questions as to whether or not the district court may issue that injunctive relief. So the government would respectfully request that this court reverse.
Could the district court grant class-wide declaratory relief instead of injunctive relief?
It could issue declaratory relief, but I would have to maybe class-wide declaratory relief. But again, the statute was meant to allow the government to determine how best to comply with such declarations made by district courts. So we would respectfully request that the court reverse the granting of the injunctive relief, but affirm on the remainder of the decision and questions and decision and order. So if there are no further questions,
I'd like to ask just a couple of quick last questions. In wrestling with the standard, and you mentioned for a while ago that in almost all of these cases, what's really at issue is just a paper showing that someone has been convicted. If that's the case, and it's that easy to show the at least the likelihood that someone falls into a 1226C category, then what is the problem for the government in terms of adopting, for example, the Joseph dissenters approach, where the government has the burden to show a likelihood of success as to that issue? If all that's at stake in most cases is just putting in the paper showing proof of conviction.
Your Honor, it's a matter of, it's a matter of what these hearings are meant to are meant to address, and these hearings are meant for these preliminary determinations as to whether of custody determinations. They're not meant to turn into, you know, as we note in our brief, mini trials or mini hearings as to whether or not somebody can or will be removed, and what it means to be subject to 1226C, and whether it meets the categorical approach or whatnot. That, so the probable cause standard is meant to address that and to allow, to not impose certain burdens on the government, as the Supreme Court has recognized, by turning these into these mini hearings and mini trials.
Are we really free to look to that after German Santos within our circuit? And to the extent that we've already decided that a clear and convincing standard comes into play where and detention under 1226C is prolonged, why shouldn't we infer from that is the appropriate standard for making the threshold determination, at least whether someone falls within one of the 1226C categories?
Your Honor, there's nothing in German Santos that acknowledges or even notes that the clear and convincing standard is appropriate at the threshold determination. Again, this court, neither in Diop nor Chavez Alvarez nor German Santos, talked about or had any issue with an individual who is litigating their removability be subject to 1226C, did not raise any note that there was a question of constitutionality, whether they were subject to 1226C. The German Santos really, and its predecessors really talk about due process being instituted and due process protections that would kick in after detention has been prolonged. So again, this court has provided due process protections at the back end by saying that somebody subject to 1226C may receive some form of relief, which is in the form of release from detention, in the form of a bond hearing before an immigration judge to challenge whether or not they should further be detained under mandatory detention.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And we'll get Mr. Lesper back on rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
You asked for what, 4 minutes of rebuttal? Is that
just
correct?
Just two, but I'm going to be extremely brief because we'll give you
four, and it'll be a hard four.
It's no problem. I'll be quicker. The court has been very generous with its time. The one issue I did not address initially was the 1251 F1 issue, which has to do with whether the injunction that was issued here was appropriate under the statute. And let me just say, I think when the court looks at that issue, it should consider very carefully whether that issue was even preserved for appeal. It is so 1251 F1 was, it's a government did not, they initially I think did cross appeal and ultimately dropped their cross appeal. So their effort today to achieve the vacation of the injunction is inappropriate. It's been waived. It's not before the court. Their response to that is that it's jurisdictional, but I would respectfully refer the court to Justice Scalia's opinion in Steele Company versus Citizens for Better Environment, where Justice Scalia says is, you know, courts use this word jurisdiction all the time. But if you look at 1251 F1, just like in Steel Co., the particular provision is called, refers to limitations on relief. It uses the phrase jurisdiction in the text of the statute, but it really has to do with limitations on relief. And as such, if the government was concerned that the court overstepped, it was required to have appealed that and to have maintained that appeal. Having said all that, as this court made clear in the footnote upon which the government relies the first time around, in your opinion, Judge Krause, that under what's pre-op says this now, but under Ali at the time, it's very clear that declaratory relief declared in class-wide declaratory relief, as you said, Judge Ambrose, is appropriate even under that statute. We set forth our position in our papers, but the government has determined not to cross appeal on that. I'll conclude with this, and I do really appreciate the amount of time that the court has given to this matter, which is very important. You know, the government argues in response to Judge Krause's questions that the due process cases to which Your Honors refer are not applicable here because we're in the immigration context. One of the most remarkable things about the government's papers in this case is its complete failure or refusal to acknowledge Zedvitas, which does not say that. What Zedvitas says, and even what Damore says, is that due process does apply in these contexts, and that due process should be limited to where we're talking about detention to very specifically identifiable circumstances, that's what Zedvitas says, that are linked, really, as Mr. Sampat says, to the purposes of the statute. And we agree with Mr. Sampat as to what those purposes were. The purposes were to prevent flight and danger to the community. The regime that we've proposed is one that would do that. It would just simply not detain people for, as the court pointed out, on the average more than a year, when ultimately they ought not be detained. And it will give them the full range of due process protections, much greater than probable cause, which is on the very low end of standards of proof in our system of justice. So that courts can be assured that those who are detained really ought to be. That's what this appeal is fundamentally about. And I really want to thank the court again for the time that it gave to this morning and throughout. Of course, I'm available to answer any questions, but I don't want to overstay my welcome either.
No. Thank you to both counsel for very well presented arguments. Mr. Lusberger, did your firm take this pro bono?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Thank you very much for the exceptional work you do, and thanks to the government for the exceptional work that it does. We would ask that a transcript be prepared of this oral argument, and if it's okay with Mr. Sampat, would the government be willing to pick that up, sir?
Yeah, sure.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you both for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, and let me just echo Mr. Lusberger's acknowledgement and thanks for taking the time with the argument.
Important stuff and well briefed and well argued. Thank you.
Thank you.